Today, in part 5 of our series, How God Uses Money to Shape Us, we focus on devotion. So just what is devotion? Love? Loyalty? Willingness to suffer? How does devotion and money affect marriage? How do we become truly devoted to God? Here's Pastor Seth.
Devotion. All right, if we talk about devotion, what is devotion? What does it mean to be devoted to someone, or to be devoted to a group of people, or to be devoted to God? And when I think of this, I think of devotion is really made up of sort of three different character qualities. The first one is an easy one. Love, yeah, but loyalty also. Because in any relationship, it starts out well, everything's going along great, roommate, marriage, kids, the new boss at work, the new employee, the new neighbors. But after a while, no matter where you turn, there's misunderstandings, conflict, hurts, all those kinds of things. And at some point, your relationship changes from, I just love being with this person, hanging out with this person, to, I'm going to continue to be in a relationship, a deepened relationship, even with baggage. Some of that's my own baggage. Some of that's the baggage that comes along. But over time, it gets more costly, and that's the quality of long-suffering. Is I am committed to this relationship, and I am going to do everything I can in this relationship to make it work, regardless of the response of the other person. That is the quality of devotion. And it's these three things together that God is trying to build into our relationship with Him, our relationship with our spouse, and our relationship with the people, His people, people in church. Now, He does this with more than just those three arenas, but that's what we're going to talk about today. Proverbs 15:17 is a verse similar to the one we looked at last week. Better a meal of vegetables where there is love than a fattened calf with hatred. Now, he said, if you look out, it's very easy to see two pictures. One picture is the poor folks that they don't have much and they're barely making it, but they've got something going on around that dining room table that's really good. And then over here, you got people who are chasing the fattened calf, he says, and they're up to their gills in debt and overspending, and they got to have the big house, and they got to have the minivan that gets the car, you know, everybody in the car, and they got to have all the accoutrements that look like a family, with sort of the underlying belief, hardly even questioned assumption, that if we have these things, then we'll have the right family. It's almost like we just sort of get on autopilot, and that's sort of the course that we take. The warning that Solomon says is, you better be careful about that, because the end of that one is not good. Hatred, conflict, or you just don't want to even be together around the dining room table. I mentioned last week, just a little bit, that when Mindy and I got married, we were dirt poor. And that wasn't a bad thing. We were content with that. We were happy to be married. We were involved in student ministry back in Texas with college students. And we loved our life. We lived in a little 600-foot house, 600 square feet. Did not have central air. It had an old gas heater that was probably built in the 1920s or something. And I would, in the winters, would light this thing in the morning because I didn't want to leave it on at night, fear of explosion or something. We didn't have any kind of central heat. So in the morning, if I get up at 6, it might be 40 degrees in our house. We had a little electric heater in our bedroom with the doors closed. And so I would run out into the living room and light the pilot on that and get that going. I'd run into the kitchen and light the 4 burners and the stove and leave the oven open and run back into our room and dive under the sheets. Wait till the house heated up. We had nothing really to buy. We had $100 to buy kind of our beginnings, which included a washer, a dryer, a refrigerator, a couch, a love seat, a coffee table, a couple chairs, our bedroom furniture, all that stuff was given to us. Now, this wasn't like, you know, new stuff. I mean, you know, the hand-me-down kind of stuff. The $100 we spent was on fabric, and we reupholstered, using that word real loosely, we reupholstered our couch and love seat that we'd gotten, and then the rest of the material, she made living room curtains. Now, when people would come over to our house, nobody walked in and said, "Wow, what a cool place. This, it's like a showpiece." There was nothing showy about the Gatchell house. And even when we moved into the first house that we bought, there was really nothing showy about that. We drove an old Dodge Dart that looked like it looked like a rectangle on a rectangle. It was a 3-speed, and Mindy was pregnant driving this thing. It didn't have the real air. It had that little air conditioning unit, yeah, down there. That was, I had an old VW bus with no air conditioning, and you know, in Fort Worth, that gets hot. You're running this thing. Nobody thought, man, look at that car. And sharp, well, I got it. But thankfully, because some tremendous role models that God put in our lives, we got off on a great start in our marriage. Now, that's not to say it was ideal. We went through the kind of transitions everybody goes through. How do you deal with conflict? How do you deal with misunderstandings? How do you deal with miscommunication? How do you deal with hurts? How do you deal with just communicating from guy to woman? Letting her know what's going on and trying to figure out making decisions together. All those things don't just happen, as you all know if you're married. It takes a while and all those things to kind of figure out, how do we do this? But there were a lot of people in our church back in Texas that came to us and asked us, how do you guys do that marriage thing? How do you do this? Because what we have is not working. That's something of what he's saying here. Better a meal of vegetables where there is love than a fattened calf with hatred. Now, the question to ask yourself here when you think about devotion is, what's my real goal? What's my real goal? It appears to me, as I just observe our Western American culture, that when you get married and start to have kids, the real goal is you want to get into a house and you want to have the family minivan. And you want to be going everywhere in the world and have kids committed to all kinds of stuff, and you're going 100 miles an hour. And then at home, you've got to have the right kitchen and the right bathroom and the right furniture in the baby's room and the right furniture in the bedroom. Well, I think the assumption is that if we have all of these things, then we're set to have a great family. Solomon says, that's a terrible assumption. You are off chasing a mirage if you think that's how it's going to happen. All right, let's look at three particular aspects here of devotion. The first has to do with marriage devotion and how God uses this with money. Marriage devotion. There was a woman who was struggling in her marriage, and she called her insurance agent and said, "Can I come in and talk to you?" Said, "Yeah." She went in. And she asked him, "If I take out $1 million life insurance policy on my husband today, and he were to die tomorrow, what would I get?" He said, "Probably the death penalty." All right, let's look at a few verses on marriage. "For this reason, a man will leave his father and mother, be united to his wife, and they will become one flesh." Now, these are common verses that you probably heard about many times on marriage. But let me just say a couple things about the verbs here. "For this reason, a man will leave his father and mother." He's talking about more than it's good to move out and move in somewhere else. Here, what he's talking about is something more along the lines of there's going to be a loyalty shift that needs to happen in your heart. For 18 or 20 years, your loyalty has been to your mom and dad. They're at the top of that totem pole. But now you're getting married, and that loyalty shift in your heart needs to, mom and dad need to come down a step, and you need to put your bride or your groom up there on that top step. That's not as easy to do as it sounds. And oftentimes, when you're married and you're trying to make decisions, what you're thinking of is, but my mother did it this way, and my father did it this way. It's that kind of thing that he's talking about here. He said, those days are behind you. You are building something new with this person, and this person, you need to relate to them as if they are the highest loyalty person now in your life. And then he says, be united to his wife, and for her to be united to her husband. And the idea here is, this is a process. This doesn't just magically happen when the pastor says, I now pronounce you husband and wife, and everybody, oh, isn't that so sweet? Well, it is sweet, but we got a long way to go to make that be united thing happen. It takes a lot of intentionality, and a lot of work, and a lot of heartache, and sometimes it takes a lot of tears. It takes a lot of humility to become united over a long period of time. The third thing he says is they will become one flesh. And I think what he's trying to say here is something like this. That's the goal. That's the long-term goal, to where someday you look at how we're making decisions and how we're relating to each other, and we say, no, we've sort of become a well-oiled machine here. All the parts are kind of working like they're supposed to. In fact, if somebody looked at us, it'd be hard for them to pick out two people. They sort of think of us now as a couple. Those are the pictures there of what devotion, the road to devotion, moves toward. Now, the question to ask yourself is, how do I get there? If you are married, you have discovered that when God said, I made them male and female, you're now thinking, no kidding. No kidding. He goes, male and female are about, we are different creatures. When I think about men and women and the differences that we bring to life, I think of that women are like this fine china teacup. There is beauty there, there is color there is richness there, but that can be easily chipped. And if it's easily chipped, it's costly. And guys, when I think about guys, I think about Tupperware. We're pretty plain. Plain. What you see is what you get. We're not complicated. How does this creature and this creature be united and come to one flesh? All right, Apostle Peter gives us a few ideas. 1 Peter 3:7, husbands, in the same way, be considerate as you live with your wives. Treat them with respect as the weaker partner and as heirs with you of the gracious gift of life. Notice the last part of this verse. It's all talked about husbands and what were some ideas about how we're to relate to our teacup. But at the end of this, he says, so that nothing will hinder your prayers. Now, there are a lot of places in the Bible that are encouraging us to pray. This kind of sticks out like a sore thumb here. What he's saying here is, this is so important, guys, that you get this right. That if you just throw up your hands and say, I give up, she's a drama queen, I'll never get it, she's just too hard to love, God is going to look at you and he's going to reach down into your financial spigot and go, you're not getting away with that. You need to humble yourself and learn what it means to love a teacup. There aren't too many places where you get this kind of warning here. Now, let's try to unpack this verse. In the same way, be considerate. That word considerate in the Greek language is made up of really two English words. Our English word, to take into consideration, and to ponder, and then to try to understand, and then to try to relate in a way that communicates that you understand her. Now, if you guys, like me, if you ever think, I just don't understand her. Well, duh. Welcome to the club. That's what he's saying. This is a process. It's not enough just to throw up your hands, oh, I just don't get her. Of course you don't. It takes some humility and listening. Tell me what's going on with you. How do you feel about life? How do you feel about our marriage? How do you feel about our kids? She will tell you. She will gladly tell you. Keep your mouth shut and your ears open, and you will make some progress here. It says, treat them with respect. It's easy to not treat your wife with respect if you don't understand her. He says, don't do that. That's a mistake. And as the weaker partner, and here he's not saying weaker physically, weaker spiritually, weaker emotionally, all that stuff. He's just saying, I think, easily chipped. You cannot relate to your wife as if she's Tupperware. I'm not going to relate to Mindy the way I relate to Scott or the way I relate to Lance or to Doug or to Wallace. If I do that, I'm an idiot. When I work with Lance most of the time, Mark's around most of the time, there's three Tupperwares upstairs. But when I go home, I'm entering into another world. I have my wife who's a teacup. I have my 27-year-old daughter who's usually sitting here as a camp. She's another teacup. And then I have my son who's I can go talk to occasionally, but he's not all that big a talker, so I don't know. It's kind of a... The two of us together are pretty pathetic. Now, what's interesting to me also about this is that notice Peter in verse 7 says, husbands in the same way. What does he mean? The verses just before this are instructions to the wife. And then he finishes so that nothing will hinder your prayers. My suspicion is that this relates both ways, husbands and wives. If I just throw up my hands and say, I just give up, God can reach down and say, that's not an option. You just need to humble yourself, get around some folks who are farther down the track, get some lunch with them, get coffee with them. You need a mentor. You need some role models. Be teachable. Be humble. Here's what he says to the ladies. Your beauty should not come from outward adornment, such as braided hair, the wearing of gold jewelry, and fine clothes. Now, he's not saying these are bad things. These are good things. But what he's saying is don't rely only on these things for beauty. Instead, it should be that of your inner self, the unfading beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is of great worth in God's sight. In this way, the holy women of the past who put their hope in God used to make themselves beautiful. Now, he mentions two things. Gentle spirit is the first one. Now, he's not talking about something outward. He's talking about there's something going on in the heart of this woman as she relates to her Tupperware. Why is a gentle spirit needed? Gentle spirit needed. Well, ladies, you probably have understood that Tupperware, it's very easy for us Tupperware folks to feel like a failure or to feel a sense of futility about our life or frustration. No matter what I do, it doesn't seem to be good enough. Not good enough at work, not good enough in our checkbook, not good enough at home, not good enough with the kids, apparently not good enough with the wife, apparently not good enough with my health. It's easy for a guy. Now, he's probably not going to tell you this because he's Tupperware. But Genesis 3 tells you those things are mulling around in the male heart, frustration, futility, sense of failure. If you relate to him as if he should be on top of the world, you're likely to be ungentle with him and come across as sandpaper does. And many men feel like we are just being sandpapered to death by our wife. Yes, you washed the kids so I could get away, but the house was a wreck. Yes, you washed the dishes, but when you took the dishes out of the dishwasher, you took the ones out of the top rack first and spilled some water on the bottom ones. Well, yes, you did clean the sheets, but you didn't get them completely dry, and I had to redo the whole thing all over again. That A guy wants to know, does anybody think I'm doing something right? He hopes, ladies, it'll be you. Now, I will say, ladies, that sometimes trying to find something he does right is a challenge. Granted. And if that's where you are, then what you are looking for is effort. Something he tried to do for you, or he tried to do for the kids. And then you want to cheer that on. The second one, he says, is a quiet spirit. Quiet, again, is spirit, not quiet in terms of outward extrovert or introvert. I'm married to an extreme extrovert, which I love. I'm happy that she's an extrovert. I wouldn't consider her quiet. I don't want her to be quiet. It's boring if she was like me at our house. But a quiet spirit means, here in 1 Peter 3, calm in a crisis. In other words, when he's just not doing what he ought to be doing, and he knows he shouldn't be doing that, and I know he shouldn't, there's something going on in you that says, is going to God and saying, God, I wish my husband was different, but he's not, and I am looking to you for my deepest needs to be met, and then I want to come alongside him in how I relate to my Tupperware in a way that's reflective of, this ship is not going to sink. There have been times where in our finances, you know, we hit a wall. And I'm sitting there going, oh, no, what are we going to do? How in the world are we going to get out of this? And that failure, frustration thing, is I can still it's starting to creep up and start to strangle me. And then you'll come over and she'll ask me about what's going on. And she just looks up and she'll kind of put her arm under my arm and kind of look up and she'll go, you know, Seth, you and God will figure that out. And there's something inside of me that is strengthened. There's something that says, maybe I can handle this. Maybe I'm not the failure it's easy for me to think I am in this realm of finances. That's what Peter says is not just a quiet spirit, but is one of the two places where beauty is seen. Beauty has the effect of drawing Tupperware to teacups. Gentle spirit, quiet spirit. Now, those are hard things to do. They take a lot of humility. It doesn't just happen. You just heard a message on this. But at least these are the tools, Peter says, moving in that direction. Trying to build that kind of in our life, and if we just throw up our hands and say no, you can expect God to reach down on the financial spigot of your bank account, work, savings, bring this thing to a trickle. Second area of devotion we're going to look at is devotion to God's people. Romans 12 says, be devoted to one another in brotherly love, honor one another above yourselves. Be devoted to one another. Think about that. He might as well have been talking to us. Be devoted to one another. How does that change how we think about each other? How we relate to each other? Are we just passing ships in the night, enjoying our coffee together? Or is there something more, something richer that God's trying to do in us? Acts 2, the early church said they devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and to the fellowship, to the breaking of bread, and to the prayers. They devoted themselves first to the apostles' teaching. It seems to me when I hear people that are almost anywhere, is they talk about church, and it's very easy to talk about the music, and it's talk about the preaching and teaching and children's program and youth program, the people, and what are the values and things. One of the shows that Mindy watches every once in a while is this, what's that wedding, the four weddings that they compare each other and they go to? Do you remember the name of that show? Somebody remember what show I'm talking about? There's four young gals, they're all doing a wedding. They go and they compare the place and the dress and the food and all this stuff. And they do these points, you know, for each other. And Whoever gets the most points gets a week in Hawaii or something like that. I'm thinking, you know, it's a reality show. I'm thinking they're going to do one for pastors. We're going to go to four different churches. We're going to sit there. We're going to critique. Was he personal? Was he thoughtful? Was he talking about the Bible? Did he give us some good insight into this? Was he funny? Did he have some good stories? Did he drive home his points? Now, those are probably good questions to ask occasionally. But that's really more like icing on a cake. Here, they devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching. They weren't really thinking about how to critique this. What they were thinking is, what is God trying to speak to me about as I'm sitting here listening to somebody teach from the Word? And to be devoted to that. They were devoted to the fellowship, to one another, to the breaking of bread and the prayers. Verse 44, all the believers were together, had everything in common, selling their possessions and goods they gave to anyone as he had need. That's an astounding statement about the early church. It tells you something about their level of devotion to the people. They were devoted more to the people than just, we need to upgrade our kitchen. Devotion. The last one let's talk about is devotion to God. 2 Corinthians 11, I'm afraid that just as Eve was deceived by the serpent's cunning, your minds may somehow be led astray from a sincere and pure devotion to Christ. This is more than, I believe in Jesus. Oh yeah, I've been a Christian a long time. This is what he's trying to build in us, a sincere and pure devotion. Luke 16, no one can serve two masters. Either he will be devoted to the one and hate the other, or hate the one, be devoted to the other. You cannot serve God and money. We've looked at this in our series. Devotion. Ezekiel gives us another picture. My people come to you as people come. They sit before you as my people. They hear what you have to say, but they will not do it. For with their lips they show much love, but their heart is set on their own gain. In other words, the people were willing to give the appearance of devotion, to even do things that looked like devotion, but that's not where their hearts were. Now, from our series, you can tell, if you were God and you saw that, what would you do? You would reach down as one of your tools on the spigot and say, no. Trying to do something deeper in your life and a relationship with me. There's a great story of this, and we're going to finish our series with this story from the little book of Haggai. At the end of the Old Testament, the people of God had never really gotten it right, and they had rebelled and gone about as far away from God as they could. And God, despite all the warnings of the prophets, finally allowed the Babylonians to come in to overrun Jerusalem and all the lands around it. They decimated the city walls around Jerusalem. They decimated the temple. They decimated the homes. There was not one stone left on another, was the history. And they took about 90% of the people off into Babylon, into exile for about 70 years. Now you'd think that group of people that went off would finally get it. What are we doing in Babylon? Why are we here? And tell that the story to their children and then to their grandchildren, and their children would tell it to their children and their grandchildren. So 70 years later, whoa, if we ever get to go back, let's not forget this lesson. They go back to Jerusalem. Haggai 1, verse 2, the Lord says, these people say, the time has not yet come for the Lord's house to be built. We've got other things to do, other priorities, other things that need to be done. Verse 4, is it a time, God asks a rhetorical question, is it a time for you yourselves to be living in your paneled houses while this house remains a ruin? Now, what he says is, as God looks down on Jerusalem, what he sees is the people have gone back to Jerusalem. They've gone into their fields. They've got the fields planted again. And they have rebuilt their homes. These are good, all good things. But then at that point when the homes are rebuilt, then it was time to upgrade. We've got things we need to upgrade. We need to put some paneling in this thing. while he says, while my house remains a ruin, which was rubble. Now, the images would be something like this. That's what God looked at. You know, that would be sort of like our version of this today. That's what God looked at. At the same time, he was looking at Jerusalem, he saw this. Now, that's not a picture of Jerusalem. That's a picture of Masada. But it gives you some idea of the rubble that was left there. And God says to the people, do you see these two pictures? Is there something that bothers you about these? And apparently not. Because he says, give careful thought to your ways, meaning they hadn't yet. And then he says, and these are just some amazing verses to me. What he says to them is, I've already reached down into your lives and you still haven't even seen it. And I'm turning the spigot lower. You have sowed much out in the fields and harvested little. How come we got such a rotten crop of corn this year? Oh, it must have been the weather. You sown much and harvested little. You eat, but never have enough. We have to go to Ralph's again? I thought we just went on Monday. You drink, but never have your fill. You clothe yourselves, but no one is warm. And you know, a time when you have the chills, and no matter how many blankets you put on, you just can't get warm. And what you take home from your paycheck, I put into a bag with holes. This is astounding. We don't think like this. When we get in a financial bind, we just get mad at our spouse. Are you overspending? Or we think about the economy. Sometimes the economy does have an effect on our finances, no question about that. But we rarely think, is there something that God is trying to do in my life that I am not getting in any other way other than for him just to reach down into the middle of my farm or my business or my home and say, nope, but we're not going any farther until we make some progress in this area. Then for the second time, he says, verse 7, give careful thought to your ways. Go up into the mountains, bring down timber, build the house, meaning the temple, so I may take pleasure in it and be honored. Now, instead of rubble, what God looks at is what he's hoping to see is something like this. That was similar to the temple of David that Solomon built. Now, does God say, so that I may be honored and I may be pleased because God has this massive ego problem and he needs this? No. If God had an ego problem and needed human beings, he would have left us a long time ago. He said, you want to go your way? Fine. What he knows about human beings that he made is we are at our best when we are most devoted to him. When I am most devoted to him, I become a much more devoted husband and a much more devoted father and a much more devoted worker and a much more devoted neighbor and a much more devoted friend or brother or sister. But if I get that first piece out of whack, if I am indifferent, fickle, it depends on how I'm feeling, then all the rest of these things are sort of like that. What's that Jenga game where you take out one of these things and whoosh, and all these pieces down at the bottom? Verse 9 says, you expected much, but see, it turned out to be little. And then he says an amazing thing. What you brought home, I blew away. What happened to our checkbook? What happened to our finances? What happened to our 401k? What happened to our paycheck? All I work hard. I bring home a lot. God's doing business with you. He's trying to shape your heart, and he's trying to shape my heart. Let's pray together. Father, we thank you for the Bible. It gives us the ability to be able to see life from your point of view and to see ourselves from your point of view. It gives us the ability to look into our human heart and to see what needs to change. It also gives us the ability to look into the human heart and see what you're trying to build. This quality of devotion is a really, really important quality to you. It may not be all that important to us, but it's certainly important to you that we become a devoted people. And wherever we are in our, as we finish this series, I guess if nothing else, we'll humble ourselves before God. Say, God, I think I may have been complaining about money and wondering about you and why you aren't providing more, and when maybe you're trying to speak to us, trying to build something in us. Help us to be wise as we look at life and you and ourselves and in how we think about money.